you heard the name Walter Cronkite?
I have.
So Eric Severide was the guy who did the political commentary on the Walter Cronkite News Hour in the 60s. You know, so you had interesting ways as kids of making fun of each other using funny nicknames, like the kid who wasn't so smart, we called Uni. Uni stood for UNIVAC, which is the name of an early computer, the kind of computer that took up the whole room. Funny and a little cruel.
Funny, a little cruel, but within the context of a camp and, yeah, you know, baseball and poking fun at, you know, batters or errors, it doesn't seem all that out of the ordinary that would happen.
No, and it wasn't, you know, what we would today call bullying. Mm-hmm. It was poking fun at it, son. There was one guy who was very, very overweight, aside from Columbia, and his nickname was Addy, but that stood for adipose, which was another word for being fat.
Now, when you go back to the camp.
Now.
Not now, when you were 25, 19, yeah, you're going back to the camp as a counselor.
Yes.
Do you stay in the main house or do you operate out of the greenie?
No, everybody had a group of kids that they were in charge of, and you lived with them in these tents. So there would be like five boys and a college kid. The girls had little wooden buildings, bunks, but the boys had tents. But nobody had a flesh toilet.
Talk about what the experience is like. And you're here in the 60s as a counselor. What is that experience like, being with five other children? You talk about the sort of panic set adventure in the Adirondacks. Were things like that happening, not necessarily to that drastic extent, were things like that happening in the camp?
Not a lot, you know. You know, it's remarkable to think about putting 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old girls and boys under the control of college students. But we all were good at it. And there were very few screw-ups. Mm.
I will admit, it does sound like a different time,
yeah,
compared to contemporary thought.
Now. But did you read the whole book? Because there was an undercurrent of not so nice going on there that I was trying to get at. And I don't know if you caught that in the last story or not.
You're talking about the heartbreak. Are you talking about the heartbreak of between the partners that Peter potentially had?
No, I'm talking about the man who was murdered in his home.
Hmm.
By an adolescent boy he had picked up in a park somewhere and taken home with him. Mm. And this was a sort of beloved older counselor. And only a couple of us knew about the murder later, but it made you rethink, oh, what was this guy doing all those years that we were there? Mm. He was something of a pedophile.
You're not talking about Lou, are you?
No.
Okay.
I'm talking about a guy named Fess.
Okay.
But okay. Fess was based on real, but I don't know exactly what happened, and so I made that part of the story up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that had happened.
How did that affect camp life?
Well, we didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
This was revealed long after the camping closed. So, however, you know, people have come up to me over the years and saying, well, you know, he did bother me in such and such a way, or so-and-so was having something of a relationship with him that struck me as uncomfortable. So people knew but didn't know,
mm-hmm,
which is kind of how those things seem to work.
growing up, did you get any, were there any implications that any of this type of behavior was going on?
Not that I was aware of in a conscious way.
All right.
Looking back, yeah, sure, you can see some things, but no.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, if something, if it happened, nobody talked about it. I don't remember it except one other case of it being other than this one particular person. But you know, it was in the language of today, a heteronormative world.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all after getting laid as fast as we could, however we could, with all these nice Jewish girls who didn't want to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm. You talk about hitchhiking,
yeah,
in this area. The camp is co-ed.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting laid, the whole courting process, going with someone,
yeah,
did that extend beyond the grounds of the camp?
Not as certainly as kids. So the hitchhiking part is when you do, is the counselor, you know, mm-hmm, college age kind of stuff that's going on, but not, no. I mean, the most you did as a 14-year-old was making out.
Mm-hmm.
That I ever heard of.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about the relationship that, we'll talk about the fictitious relationship between Peter and Ellen. Did you borrow from what memories throughout your like adolescence and youth did you borrow from?
Ellen is a version of a serious girlfriend I had in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you want to expound on? You both ended up, you both met here at the camp.
We went as kids.
Mm-hmm.
We knew exactly each other. I'm about 3 years older than she is.
Not from the same neighborhood as you.
She's from Brooklyn, I was from Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm trying to remember. I think there was a point at which I had already been working there for 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then she joined the staff, so she was like 3 years younger than I. But she was from like a different child generation,
mm-hmm,
at that age. So then we worked at camp together for the next 3 or 4 years. And we're friends and good friends, and then had a sort of a serious affair that lasted about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been friends ever since.
You talk about the number of friends that you've met and are able to keep in touch with.
Yeah.
Could you talk more about how going to camp in this area, in Otsego County,
yeah,
on the edge of Otsego Lake, strengthens the bond, you think, between two children over the course of a lifetime?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think on the one hand, there's this sort of context of the natural beauty,
mm-hmm,
of the place, and that it was literally sheltered from the world we all came from. Once you got here, that world didn't exist. You weren't allowed to call home. If somebody got a package of, say, candy from their parents, the rule was you had to share with everybody. It was a real, it sort of enforced a too strong moral. It was a structured community. And the less the outside world intruded on it, the better. The happier everybody was. So it was a place where a certain kind of vanity and egotism stopped existing. It was a place where social and racial differences were not important. This is true. I have, again, a dear friend who was my sports counselor then, a black guy, who's like a big shot out there in the world today. And he comes every summer when I have these little reunions, and he will always say, you know, this camp was the most racially benign place I've ever been in my life. And he says that till today. And he was dean of the school of social work at Boston University. Founded City here. So he knows what he's talking about. But he taught me how to play first base.
He taught you how to play first base. Was that your favorite position?
Well, they didn't really. You know what? It's again how these things work as you're a kid. I was playing first base. Mm-hmm. I was maybe 12. And he comes up to me afterwards and said, hey, you're really good at that. I said, who, me? You know, and then I decided I was good at it.
Going to this particular camp, was this your first interaction with people of a different ethnicity than yourself?
No, because the schools had a similar philosophy.
How were camp children, especially being integrated at the time, received by the Otsego community?
Honestly, I have no idea.
Acceptable.
I wasn't, you know, I didn't experience buzzing, cognitive dissonance. I didn't experience any of that. But I don't remember either as a counselor being aware of it when I was with kids who were from mixed racial backgrounds going in different places too. It didn't have a role. I remember thinking that, and I just talked about this with somebody the other day, that they, meaning Cooperstown people, thought we were some kind of left-wing nudist colony, offbeat, weird, but it wasn't about race. It was just like being hippies before there were hippies. Mm-hmm.
What does a hippie Ruckoff look like growing up?
No different than this one, except a little younger.
You say,
and I wasn't hip or hippie then. It's just that that's the thing. That's what we thought. They thought.
Understandable.
Ethical culture. What?
Now, speaking of ethical culture,
yeah,
we talk about the sacrifice meal.
Yeah.
How did the school, or the camp rather, how do they include ethical culture or ethical behavior or ethics in general into the camp?
It was all built on the unseen structures of progressive education, which I only know after the fact. Mm-hmm. Everything you did, you talked about. Everything you discussed in public. That it was a non-authority kind of place. The role of the director was to make sure everybody was safe, to handle the petty cash, mm-hmm. to hire responsible counselors, and get the hell out of the way. You know, literally, for example, I know this because I helped work it. My first wife was somebody I met working here, and she became the head counselor. And we would literally, every kid had his own schedule based on what they wanted to do. Mm. So, for example, you know, you would have art class at 9, swimming at 11, sailing at 2. That was your schedule. Mm-hmm. Right? So that you could do what you wanted as long as you did it. Choice and structure.
You say choice and structure, but no one is allowed to call home.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Talk about how that affected the dynamics at work between the camp counselors and the campers.
Okay, this is actually a good question. Because so many of us had gone to the camp as kids, we internalized all of the rules and culture of the camp, and God forbid anybody would want to change them. because they were fucking with paradise. In other words, if it has lasted 2 summers, it became a tradition, and you don't mess with tradition. Lots of camps work this way. So it was a very closed community. One more thing that's important. The schools and the camp had a policy that a third of the kids had to be on some kind of financial aid, which was a serious commitment in the 1950s, for example. And one of the goals of the camp was that you didn't want people to be able to dress, act in ways that were revealing of the background that they came from. Everybody was really supposed to be equal, right? So you didn't have fancy clothes and not fancy clothes. Sneakers were sneakers. There was none of that kind of branding crapola that you've all grown up with. It was like we were all playing in the same sandbox with the same plastic lunch pail, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It was very nice. Because it gets rid of all those jealousies and envies and competitions.
One would be able to say that baseball itself is an example of a meritocracy where you're judged on something, you know, that certainly doesn't have anything to do with your skin color,
right?
Or you know your intellect beyond understanding the rules and how to play.
You can say that, but it's not true.
We both know that.
That's the academic speaking.
Certainly. Could you talk about how these activities were supervised? You're on Otsego Lake.
They were always interactive with counselors. In other words, as a counselor, you had responsibility for a group, mm-hmm. five, normally 6 year olds. But they went off on their schedules, right? And you became then the baseball teacher or the swimming counselor or the drama coach, right?
Mm-hmm.
During the course of the day. And then in the evening and meal times, you came back together in your tent group. So does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
So everybody was a specialist. I was the swimming guy.
I was just about to ask.
Yeah.
You were the swimming guy. What were some of the activities that you supervised or chaperoned out here on Otsego Lake?
I'm going to say something first.
Please.
The lake was one of the great teachers of my life, and that's one of the things I love about this place today, is I learned how to tell the weather. I can tell you if a storm is coming, because I paid attention to the water. And I did that as a kid, and you do it as you learn how to sail, and I certainly had to do it if I was running a swimming program with 120 kids. And you wanted everybody to be safe. So you just, you know, just the total environment for a city kid to be out here, like at the end of the dock, and the stars are out at night, and the wind is blowing, and you look across the lake, and the cows are lying down. Oh, there's a storm coming tomorrow. So the lake was a great instruction to me, and that's one of the reasons I feel so attached to the locale. It kind of was one of my basic teachers.
Can you describe for me beyond just knowing how to tell the weather by the lake?
Yeah.
Could you talk more about how the lake itself was one of your teachers?
The lake was the first place I felt competent in the world, where I felt pretty incompetent in a world up until I became a pretty good swimmer and a canoeist and a sailor. I had control and even excelled at some things that had to do with the water. So it was good for myself.
Can you talk about how you interact with the lake now?
The only reason, I can't not be here, not be around the lake. It's just, it still has that kind of, it has a very elemental spiritual feel to me. Mm. And if I were a Christian, I could say it has a kind of baptismal feel. But the water has a very particular quality that I've never experienced anywhere. Literally how it feels. Mm. And it's so spiritual and sensual both at the same time. I was happier at this camp and at this lake than any place in my childhood, by far.
Could you describe for me the spiritual connection, as it were, that you have with the...
Well, lake? It's again a sense of being connected. It's a oneness with things. So I'm at home in all the different levels you could be at home in this locale. I was at home, you know, in the water. I was at home in the camp community. I was at home with friends. Yeah. You ever hear the phrase from William James called beloved community?
Beloved community.
Yeah.
Beloved, yes, but together, no.
A community that's totally mutually supportive and loving. And that's what we had there. It's really unusual. It's utopian.
Can you describe for me your initial thoughts coming into this camp? You start camp at age
10.
Yeah. You start camp at age 10. Do you remember how you felt coming into the camp, this new place, meeting these new children?
It was a new camp. I had been to one that I liked. So I was pissed off that I was being sent to a new place. But I don't remember having any adjustment issues at all. I happen to have a photograph that a friend of mine sent me of my first summer at the camp, and we had an amazing counselor, a Japanese American guy whose name was Earl Hiramoto, and he could do everything. He didn't talk, but he did. He made jewelry. He could sail. He canoed. He was like shorter than you and larger than you and stronger than hell. And he was, you know, it's just one of these. It's all these personalities.
Mm-hmm. This particular counselor you're talking about, in the novel at least, he runs the metal shop.
Yeah.
What were some of your experiences in his class?
I don't remember the particularly, but I liked metal shop. Metal shop, you could make jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
Clay, you made crappy ashtrays. Pottery. But, you know, I can't remember. The only thing I remember is making a really nice peach pit ring for Ellen. But we were older then.
Okay.
You know what a peach pit ring is?
A peach pit ring.
Peach pit. Take a peach pit, and you sand it, and you sand it, and you sand it, and then you drill a hole in it. And it comes out like this beautiful piece of polished, gnarled wood.
Hmm. Okay. I don't know why that. Yeah. In my mind, I imagined the jelly ring, the jelly peach ring that you buy in there.
No, this is like a...
This is actual craft work.
Yeah. Some people would walk around all day long, you know, sanding the thing down finer and finer and finer and finer.
Yeah. What are some other craft work shops or skills that they taught at these camps?
Well, that was really cool. I mean, you learned how to use tools.
Mm.
You know, woodworking tools, saws, planes, drills, sandpapers, grits of sandpapers, you know, all that kind of stuff. If you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked wood shops, so I was good. When I was 14, we would have a camp yearbook. And I became one of the two editors. And that was like a big deal. I felt, you know, prestigious and elevated. And, you know, I gave out assignments. And we printed the whole thing, and it was a quite, for that age and for my time in life, it was an accomplishment. Mm-hmm. The editor.
Describe for me some of your duties as the editor. 15 as an editor of the yearbook.
You have a committee, and you decide what stories are we going to have in the magazine. This is in like the end of June, and the thing's going to come out 7 weeks later. You're going to cover the baseball season. You're going to cover sailing. You're going to do the trips, those kinds of things. But it was more the camaraderie of working on it together, whatever the particular activity was. And we had this crappy, you don't even know what this is, machine that you had to turn a handle and crank to make copies.
I can imagine.
Before there were Xerox machines, there were these blue sticky things called stencils, and you typed them, mm-hmm. and then you put it on a machine with ink, mm-hmm. and you turned it and made copies. It's really primitive. Rexograph was one of them. It doesn't matter, but the whole process of doing that together, mm. Oh my God, we have to get this done in 2 days. We got to put out, make all the stories. We've got to type it up. We've got to put it out. We've got to lay it out. We've got to collate it. And that was all fun.
So you mentioned woodworking.
Yeah.
We spoke about metals.
Yeah.
You just talked about, the yearbook.
Yeah.
Are there best crafts in the yearbook? Are there best metal crafts in the yearbook?
Well, it wasn't so much as awards, but yeah, there were always, depending on who was doing what, but there was always a story about all of those kinds of activities, mm-hmm. which always read exactly the same and ended up with a phrase like, and all in all, everybody really had fun this summer.
Did you talk about the baseball season, yeah. and some of these other sports? I know baseball in particular, a big thing about baseball is keeping stats. In this particular yearbook, did you keep records and scores?
Maybe some scores, maybe a highlight or two. Nobody was keeping batting averages. We always, at the end of the summer, we always had a camp counselor game. Mm-hmm. It's like an all-star game. Mm-hmm. And of course, the counselors are 20-year-old big guys, and the kids are scoring little things, but it was fun.
How were those games? It sounded entertaining.
They were simply entertaining. Yeah. And that goes back to the Gillespie's running stuff. Mm-hmm. There would be maybe three girls would stand up and be cheerleaders at a game, but maybe not. But it also gave you a sense, like I was talking about other stuff, a sense of, you're actually accomplishing something. Now, on the scale of baseball activity, mm-hmm. I think I wrote this in the book, I got to be a pretty decent softball hitter. It's not in the scheme of things, so what? But I could hit it, in a sense, out of the park, mm-hmm. which was in a place called the Bushes. When I go back to that place 20 years later, the Bushes are like over there, So But at the moment, it felt great.
Naturally. You talk about hearing that familiar sound when the bat hits the baseball and you're playing outfield and the ball goes past your glove and someone yells, "Gillespie's running."
Yeah.
were errors on your part a big part of the game?
And also, that's part of the thing that I made up, mm-hmm. as part of the story.